Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
Support for The Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. The mutual antagonism at play right now between the U.S. and Iran is nothing new. For years, the United States has sought to thwart Iran's influence in the Middle East, and Iran has carried out attacks on American interests through proxy militia groups. It's complicated, and it raises many questions and possibilities. Here to help us understand it better is UNH Assistant Professor Jeannie Sowers, a longtime Middle East expert. And Jeannie, welcome. It's really great to have you.
Thank you, Laura. It's nice to be here.
So you've studied this region, as I said, for a long time, Jeannie. How did you view this recent series of attacks and counterattacks and, you know, the killing of the Iranian general, the downing of the airline? There's been a lot going on. So just how do you view this broadly, Jeannie, please?
Sure. So just two quick things before we start to talk. I basically want to just say that I'm representing my own views. I'm here in my professional capacity, but I don't represent the University of New Hampshire. And also, Laura, I'm actually an associate professor.
Oh, I apologize. No, I said assistant. You're an associate.
Fine.
And there's
I've
a difference.
I've been here for 15 years. So, no. So to broadly go to your very, very important question, I think the way I would see this is that it's been sort of the predictable outcome of backing unilaterally out of the nuclear deal, in which Iran was in compliance with the deal. So if we revisit the whole bargain that was on the table for the deal, Iran wanted relief from longstanding U.S. economic sanctions, and the United States wanted to slow down or stop Iran's nuclear program. That is the point of the deal. So when Donald Trump said that he wanted to basically unilaterally pull out and then did pull the United States out, Iran, of course, then felt that it had been left and under sanctions. And so both sides, if you like, of course, have been involved in ratcheting up this confrontation. And I would say that both sides have been losing as a result.
So some have called this assassination, this killing an assassination. Mm-hmm. Some have called it an act of war. Some have said, no, we took a bad guy out. You know, he was a big terrorist, he had American blood on his hands. Lots of sort of charged language there, Jeannie. Why is this so important?
So I think it's, to use our terminology correctly in political science, it is not, he's not a terrorist because he's not a non-state actor, right? So in general, you could talk about state terrorism, but Soleimani was actually sort of an official, right? I mean, he's an actual member of the Republican Guards and also the Iranian military. So technically, it is a political assassination. And the question of whether it's a good idea or not is, of course, too early to say. But what we can say is that that doesn't substitute for foreign policy. So, again, the question we should be asking is, what do we want to happen in Iran in the longer term? And in the longer term, we would want to see in Iran what many, many Iranians want, which is they want a more accountable regime that follows the rule of law. They also want an economy that's able to supply basic services and employment. And if you look at Iran in that context, it's so similar to other countries in the Middle East, some of which are struggling with the same issues. So the Iranian protesters in the streets today have been in the streets over the past year. They were in the streets in 2009. They've been in the streets sort of, you know, intermittently for decades. And they therefore look similar to the protests that we see in other parts of the region. Lebanon is in protest. Sudan was having protests. Algeria. And then, of course, we had the 2011 uprisings. And the structural drivers of all of these rounds of protest are the same: urbanized middle classes who want better employment and better governance. And the only way that can come is if their countries are integrated into the world economy and not cut off from them through sanctions.
So from one perspective, it seems like, Jeannie, sanctions work if you want to create instability for a certain regime?
Well, I think that's, again, a question of what do you want, right? So the U.S. generally supports protests when it doesn't like the regime. and ignores them or actually actively supports the repression of protests when it wants to keep the regime in power. So if we look at the Trump administration's attitude towards Egypt, Saudi Arabia, those countries, we've supported absolute repression of essentially the same kind of protest movements. So yes, economic sanctions absolutely undermine an economy and make life difficult for ordinary people. Does that result in regime change? So far, the evidence in the Middle East is that decades of sanction on Saddam Hussein did not remove him from power. Decades of economic sanction on Iran did not change the regime, and there's no reason to think that a new round of these sanctions will do the same. That being said, we can't predict in advance the extent of social mobilization, and that's what you should learn from 2011, 2012. No one thought Mubarak would be out, and Tunisia's dictator would be out, and Yemen's dictator would actually be fleeing to Saudi Arabia. So we don't know whether this will produce some more form of regime change. But what we do know is that when you see regime change in these kind of conditions, you have two possible outcomes that are very likely. The first is civil war, so Syria, Libya, Yemen. The second is absolute sort of state failure and collapse, which is Iraq after the 2003 war. So under no scenario is destabilizing an important country with a large, educated, urbanized middle class really going to get you to better governance, right, and better accountability. So our record is very, very spotty that economic sanctions leading to protests, leading to regime change is actually good for U.S. interests.
Very interesting. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We are looking more at U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, especially with Iran and Iraq, given recent events. Our guest is Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH and a scholar of comparative politics in the Middle East. And the number for you to join us with your comments or questions about this region and what the U.S. has been doing there is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, too, if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. One more time, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. Getting back for a few minutes, Jeannie, to, again, what's just been happening the last, you know, week or two with the U.S. and Iran. Some observers have said this is the most serious confrontation between the two countries since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the takeover of the U.S. embassy. Some of us remember that. What do you think?
I think that's actually correct. And I think the tragic downing of the Ukrainian air flight done by the Iranian authorities who had put their air defenses on high alert is a really good example of how miscalculation and misperception in a moment of tension lead to large numbers of civilian deaths, right? In this case, 176 people, I believe. But also, if you think about this moment of tension, it also then is opening up space for groups like ISIS to sort of start reorganizing. So again, tension and confrontation with a regime you don't like, the question is, what do you want to achieve by this? And I think by pretty much most accounts, we're now worse off, and so are the Iranians, and both ordinary Iranians, but also the regime, than we were about 5 years ago in about 2013.
After the killing and then the Iranian attack on bases housing Americans in Iraq. I know you know all this, Jeannie. I just want to refresh everybody's memory, though,
please.
Because there's been a lot going on.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And then last week, the president had that news conference. He said there weren't casualties in that Iranian attack in Iraq, again, on a base housing Americans. And that appeared, the president said, to be dialing things down a little bit, calming things down. How much do you see de-escalation now, Jeannie, and some possibility for gaining stability in the region?
Well, I think those are two separate questions. I think neither Iran nor the U.S. wants to go to war, which is a good thing when push comes to shove. But that's never really been the goal. I mean, that's never been an issue, right? So we haven't been sort of facing war with Iran. So the reason we're facing war with Iran is because of the policy choices over the past few years. So I think wisely so, both sides are realizing that they actually have to step back from the brink. The attack on the two bases, actually one in, I think it was Anbar province and one in Erbid. I think there's no casualties, which is absolutely amazingly wonderful. But I think what what's happening is that Iraq is now being used, right, both by the Americans and by the Iranians to make these statements, right, to sort of, you know, send these signals. But for Iraq, that's, of course, making it actually more unstable and their sort of security situation feel more tenuous, sort of for everyday people as well as for the regime. So using Iraq, if you like, as this kind of place in which you're bargaining is also extremely dangerous because the Iraqi government is very, very weak. And if we think about the whole rise of ISIS and the sort of whole rise of many, many sort of non-state actors and militias that came out of the result of the 2003 war, sort of the failure to rebuild a strong federal government, which, you know, may or may not ever happen, we're looking at sort of a sort of place of instability which can only be dealt with in much longer engagements, not in these kind of just ratcheting back and forth tensions.
I would love for you to explain to me and our listeners the relationship between Iraq and Iran. Again, I was just trying to explain the idea that Iran ordered some airstrikes on an airbase in Iraq where Americans were, so it's tangled up. The two countries fought a long war in the 80s when Iraq invaded Iran. Can you just describe the relationship between these two neighbors for us, Jeannie, because it matters a lot?
Sure, and I think it's changed a lot since the Saddam Hussein regime was actually taken out. So you're right, under Saddam Hussein, Iraq invaded Iran. There was actually almost an 8 to 9 year war, in which was actually one of the costliest wars in the Middle East in terms of the actual number of people who were killed. I think most families lost someone. And I think that's something we should remember, that for Iraqis who have now lived through decades of war and sanctions, these are very real questions. Going to war is not a hypothetical, right? Going to war means things you already know. You're going to lose electricity. You're not going to have water. Your children are not going to go to school. You're not going to have jobs. So when sort of the U.S. very casually, I think, invokes things like war, or the Iranians evoke war, for ordinary people, this is a huge deal. So to get back to your question about the relationship, I think it changed greatly because with the fracturing of the Iraqi state and all these different groups competing for power, and as a demographic majority, the sort of government becomes more dominated by political parties affiliated with Shiite movements and organizations who had long ties to Iran. Now, why they had long ties to Iran is, of course, that they were supported as the opposition against Saddam Hussein. So the Iranian sort of organizations and militias had long ties. But once ISIS came along, sort of, and the country descends into civil war, the Iranians, of course, also have to deal with this right on their doorstep. So I think one way to think about Iran and Iraq is, of course, that they are neighbors. They may not agree on everything. They may share important priorities. But the important thing is they have to actually be able to deal with each other. They have a 1,400 long kilometer border, land border, some of which is contested. They have huge economic ties. So I think as of last year, trade between Iran and Iraq was running at about $9 to $12 billion, most of which was Iranian exports going to Iraq. And the two countries just signed actually some trade agreements over the past year to increase that volume of trade to $20 billion. And there's, of course, all of these cross-border ties with proxy forces and militias. So Iran supports militias. But in Iraq, we should remember, as in Syria, that many countries support proxy forces. So often we're talking as if Iran is the only power in the region doing this. But the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Russia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates all support proxy forces in Syria, which, of course, can cross borders into Lebanon, into Iraq, and sort of, you know, other territories as well.
Okay, I have a lot more to ask you about this after a short break, including the recent decision by the Iraqi parliament voting to expel U.S. troops. There's more to that than just the headline, so we'll definitely dig into that after a short break. And we'll hear from you. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. More with Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH, on the situation in the Middle East, especially Iran and Iraq. We'll talk about more of that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Franklin Savings Bank has been a supporter of New Hampshire Public Radio for many, many years.
Don Beers is head of marketing for Franklin Savings Bank and a proud NHPR underwriter.
For us, it was important to attract those who choose to live, work, and play in the communities that we serve.
Learn more about how to connect with NHPR's community-minded audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest today is Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH and a scholar of comparative politics in the Middle East. And we've been talking about rising tensions with Iran, Iraq, and the U.S., getting Professor Sowers' take on all that has been happening there in recent weeks. And Professor Sowers, back to the big headline after the killing of this general, the Iraqi parliament voted to expel American troops. Seems like we're still there, Professor Sowers. So I'd love your take on that. How widespread was that Iraqi support for getting American troops out, and what you think of the situation in general?
Sure. I think that the vote was, again, a political statement more than anything else. I don't think that either side is actually ready for a precipitous withdrawal of the remaining troops that are there. And I think when you looked at the parliamentary vote, I believe most of the Kurdish deputies and the Sunni deputies, both representing kind of political parties that are somewhat founded on a sectarian basis, actually did not vote. They simply didn't vote, or they voted against, but most simply didn't vote. So I think, of course, different parties in Iraq have different stances on whether they want the U.S. to continue being there. And I think, again, the real kind of question is, how can we move forward out of a situation where our principal response to that vote was the administration essentially saying, well, we're going to now put sanctions on Iraq, right? So that kind of response actually just inflames nationalist sentiments in Iraq and Iran, and therefore makes it harder for moderate politicians within Iraq to actually support the sort of continuation of U.S. troops, which I think they think is in their interest, right? Because it's actually an important factor for them. So the sort of lesson to draw here, I think, again, is that when we escalate our discourse and our language, we actually embolden and empower hardline groups within these countries. And we actually undermine the attempts on both Iran and Iraq. Actually, there's significant moderate parties and factions, and they have less pull and less say when the tenor of the U.S.-Iran or U.S.-Iranian-Iraqi dialogue is so warlike and so bellicose. It makes it very difficult for moderates to get traction internally.
Well, speaking of that, I wanted to ask you, Professor Sowers, about the role of clerics in these conflicts. Mm-hmm. A top Shiite cleric in Iraq called for all Iraqi factions, including Iranian-backed militia, to cease military actions, so kind of asking for everyone to dial it back. How much power or influence do they have?
I think you're talking about Muqtada al-Sadr,
yeah,
who is a very well-known Shiite leader in southern, especially the southern reaches of Baghdad. His militia was actually involved in the 2000s in many actions against U.S. troops.
Because that name is familiar. Yes.
Yeah, they believed it was that the U.S. was occupying their country and they wanted them out. But they also, by the same token, don't want extensive Iranian influence in their country. I mean, they're sort of Iraq for the Iraqis, if you like. So, yes, they've been calling for a de-escalation because, again, war is not a hypothetical thing, and they don't want a war, and they've been living through it. And everyone knows that that is absolutely the worst possible outcome for Iraqis and for Iranians. So ordinary people never would like to see a war, and they don't want their leaders dragging them into it through either intention or miscalculation.
What have, by the way, Professor Sowers, the 5,000 or so American troops been doing in Iraq?
That's a very good question. I think they've been primarily based kind of doing special operations against ISIS, the sort of remaining groups that are affiliated not just with ISIS, but other sort of extremist groups. The U.S. also has the largest embassy in the world in Baghdad, in the Green Zone, which is the fortified kind of central area of Baghdad. But actually, the number of people who are actually there now has significantly gone down since the 2000s. So the remaining troops have been primarily involved in these kind of operations against ISIS and other groups, but also conducting operations in Syria, actually, until, again, there was sort of a withdrawal and sort of precipitous, of course, change of alliance. alliances by sort of abandoning the Kurdish forces that the U.S. had been supporting just a few months ago under the current administration.
Professor Sowers, let's bring our listeners into our conversation. Michael's joining us from Newmarket. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm wondering if in Iran's long history, you might touch upon the 1953 coup engineered by the Americans and the CIA and the British, where we deposed their elected prime minister and imposed the Shah of Iran, who ended up having a long stay with repression and secret police, and leading to the hostage taking and our refusal to to send the Shah back for prosecution and all that long drama. And I wonder if, and we can't undo that, but if we can't get past this and have a peaceful relationship like we have with our World War II and Vietnam adversaries, there's no reason why the people of Iran should have sanctions put on them and try to bring down the government. I don't think that will lead to people greeting us with roses, as was promised in Iraq.
Well, Michael, thank you very much. And he alluded to that long and very interesting history back in the late 70s and early 80s. So go ahead, Jeannie. I'd love your thoughts there.
Michael, thank you so much. You raised such an important episode in history, which is, of course, that the popularly elected Prime Minister Mossadegh was overthrown by kind of a combination of covert CIA activities and also internal dissatisfaction in the regime because of economic sanctions. So Mossadegh, who's popularly elected in one of the first sort of very competitive elections in Iranian history, becomes prime minister. And the first thing that he does is a long-standing nationalist demand to nationalize the oil industry, the Anglo-Iranian oil company. He nationalizes it, and what happens? Britain and the United States turn around, put comprehensive economic sanctions on Iran, and the Iranian economy, which was highly dependent on oil exports at the time, almost collapses. And that brings down Mossadegh, because basically, again, the economy is suffering. So you're absolutely right. We helped create an authoritarian dictatorship that then lasted until 1979 in a popular revolution. So thank you so much for reminding us of this very long history. And your simple point, I think, is very important. There's absolutely no reason that you can't envision a future in which there is sort of slow, incremental, domestic, demanded, quiet regime change inside Iran. That is the way in which you could see a future in which, as you said, in Vietnam, you can actually have very constructive relationships. But the way that happens is very, very important. And the last thing I just want to add is that the U.S. also has the same pattern with other autocratic regimes in the Middle East. So just as the Shah actually finally went down in a conflagration of popular, basically, mobilization, the same has just happened in 2011, 2012. And it may well happen in the Gulf monarchies. It may well happen elsewhere in the region. So you're absolutely right. We forget these episodes sort of to our peril.
Well, and Professor Sowers, so we've talked a lot about, actions that the U.S. has taken that you say have made the situation worse, inflamed tensions, and so forth. What about Iran, though? They're not just a helpless victim in this whole situation.
Oh, absolutely not. I think the way to think about Iran is that it's a relatively, on the world stage, weak regime, weak state, and therefore the reason they want nuclear weapons is deterrence. So from their perspective, they live in a neighborhood in which Iraq is in shambles, Libya and Yemen and Syria are in shambles. They face three extremely hostile players. Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, is more authoritarian and, frankly, a scarier place to live than Iran, Israel, and the U.S. This is what they see around them. And like North Korea and other states that have actually sought nuclear capacity, they're seeking it to deter what they see as an implacably hostile set of adversaries. So if we think about it that way, then we can start to understand why they are using proxy forces and other means to assert themselves in the region. So as a large, they're demographically big, their economy is big, and they have a regional role to play. And the question is, how can we shift the discussion about what that regional role is from simply one of confrontation, isolation, and supposed containment, which is clearly not working, to something that's more constructive in the long run? And that was the point of the nuclear agreement. relief of economic sanctions, you stop your nuclear program. And again, it's very important to realize the Iranians had stopped it. They were perfectly capable of compliance. The U.S. certified them in compliance. They were not breaking any rules. But from their point of view, why should they negotiate with us again? Because now we have no credibility.
What do you think is most important for Americans to understand about this situation, Professor Sowers?
I think that we all lose when we don't have a sustained vision for sort of constructive engagement.
Constructive engagement with people who have backed proxy wars against Americans. And even, you know, even people running against President Trump said that the general who was killed had American blood on his hands. So it's sometimes it's hard to engage with these people when, again, they're killing your soldiers.
Yes, but I think that's absolutely true. I mean, there's no point in sort of saying that people aren't committing atrocities. That's not the point. That is important. But the U.S. is also committing atrocities, but we don't want to talk about it. So if we look at the war in Yemen, the U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia. Without the U.S. support, we cannot prosecute the war in Yemen. It simply cannot happen. And yet the Trump administration overrode a congressional bill to essentially stop that support, because who is suffering there? Massive hunger, cholera, and malnutrition. So the question is, do we engage diplomatically with regimes to move them towards better behavior, or do we simply try old policies that, in this case, we've had decades of sanctions, they never worked. All they're going to do is harden Iran's commitment to having deterrence through nuclear weapons.
Well, Professor Sowers, we could have talked a lot longer. We really appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH and a scholar of comparative politics in the Middle East. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.